It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The White House, major U.S. media outlets, and fact-checkers are debunking President-elect Donald Trump's claims that millions of people voted illegally in the November 8th election. Trump claims he would have defeated Democrat Hillary Clinton in the popular vote if it weren't for millions of people who he said voted illegally. He did not offer any evidence for the claim, but White House spokesman Josh Earnest says there isn't any evidence.
I think what I can say is an objective fact is that there's been no evidence produced to substantiate a claim like that.
The Wisconsin Elections Commission agreed Monday to do a recount of the presidential ballots from the recent election. Wisconsin Election Commissioner Administrator Mike Haas says it will be difficult to get the job done in time.
Many of our counties we expect to be finished in a week or a little over a week. But if you talk about Dane County, Milwaukee County, Greene County, Waukesha County, some of our more populous counties, it is going to be a challenge.
Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who petitioned for the recount, sued the agency after it refused to do the recount by hand. President-elect Donald Trump met with another possible candidate for Secretary of State Monday, former CIA chief and retired General David Petraeus. That's before leading the CIA. Petraeus was the top U.S. commander in Iraq. He led NATO forces in Afghanistan, but he was forced to resign from the CIA in disgrace after leaking classified information to his biographer with whom he was having an affair. Despite Petraeus' past, Mr. Trump did say in a tweet that he was very impressed with the retired general. More at VOAnews.com. A Somali student at Ohio State University drove his car into a crowd of pedestrians and then got out and began stabbing people with a butcher knife. 11 people were wounded. Craig Stone is the chief of the Ohio State University Police Department.
A male suspect drove a vehicle over the curb, West 19th, west of College Avenue, struck pedestrians. He exited the vehicle and used a butcher knife to start cutting pedestrians. Our officers was on scene in less than a minute, and he ended the situation less than a minute. He engaged the suspect, and he eliminated the threat.
The attacker, identified as Abdul Razak Ali Artan, was shot and killed by police who considered the incident a terrorist attack. Artan was a student at the school. He was about 20 years old. Cubans lined up in Havana's Revolution Square Monday to pay their last respects to Fidel Castro. Memorial services began early Monday after 21 gun salutes sounded simultaneously in the capital and in the eastern city of Santiago, where Castro started the Cuban Revolution in 1953. The government has declared a 9-day period of mourning. The 90-year-old former communist dictator died Friday after a long illness. Kurdish commander saying American volunteer fighting with Kurdish militia was killed Monday in a battle against Islamic State fighters in northern Syria. The American was reported killed north of Raqqa, where U.S.-backed forces are fighting the Islamic State group as part of an offensive to free the city. And Syrian government forces captured a wide section of the rebel-held area of Aleppo. They are threatening to dislodge the rebels from their last major urban stronghold. There are reports of panic and retreat in the rebel-held areas. Reclaiming all of Aleppo would be a big step forward for the embattled government. A U.S. defense official says an Iranian boat pointed its weapon Saturday at a U.S. helicopter launch from the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower in the Strait of Hormuz. He called the action of the Iranians both unprofessional and unsafe. The Eisenhower was traveling through the strait when its crew saw two small Iranian Revolutionary Guard boats. The U.S. vessel launched a helicopter to investigate, and that's when, according to the official, one of the boats pointed a weapon at the helicopter. In a setback to efforts to end the war in Yemen, Houthi rebels and their allies have announced the formation of a new government in Sana'a. The Houthi-controlled Saba News Agency said the government is tasked with establishing order and confronting Saudi aggression. I'm Tommy McNeil, Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UN aid officials say Central African Republic can turn around with sustained international support.
We're really here to appeal among member states for greater attention and greater support for a humanitarian emergency that is largely forgotten or at least overshadowed by other more mediatic crises.
That's Fabrizio Schwarzschild, the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator in the Central African Republic. The U.S. expresses concern over human rights and fundamental freedoms in Cameroon. Drought-tolerant grass boosts milk and meat production in Kenya. And the European Union pledges more support for humanitarian needs in Malawi.
The European Union has allocated over 16 million in emergency assistance in humanitarian field alone, and of course disaster risk reduction projects to help the countries most vulnerable.
That's EU Commissioner Christos Stalianidis speaking Monday after a visit to Chikwawa, Malawi. The special representative of the UN Secretary General says she's disappointed the hopes of South Sudanese have not been fulfilled. And the death of Fidel Castro highlights stark differences between President Obama and President-elect Donald Trump over Cuba. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN aid officials say they are upbeat at the prospect of the Central African Republic becoming a stable, peaceful country, but they acknowledged that this will be a challenge that will require the sustained support of the international community. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Central African Republic has been lurching from crisis to crisis over the past two decades. The country remains one of the poorest in the world, with socioeconomic statistics that rank near the bottom of every international study. For example, United Nations data show 1 in 5 children will die before the age of 5. 1 in every 10 women will die in childbirth, and close to half of all children who grow to adulthood will suffer from chronic malnutrition, a malady with long-term physical and mental health consequences. Despite these and other statistics, the UN Humanitarian Coordinator in the CAR, Fabrizio Hochschild, says the United Nations believes the CAR is a country that can be turned around for the better and that it has taken some very important steps in that direction.
It has its first ever democratically elected government, an open government that acknowledges its challenges, a government more than ready to work with the international community. It has the largest ever international mission, MINUSCA, working there in partnership with the African Union.
Hochschild says the international community agrees about what needs to be done to make the CAR a viable, self-functioning state. He notes those elements are reflected in the 5-year National Recovery and Stabilization Plan that was launched in Brussels November 17 and netted $2.2 billion in pledges. While this is gratifying, Hochschild warns there are no quick fixes, but that there is a chance now to deal with the root causes of the problems facing this troubled country. He says the CAR can become a beacon of peace in the region if the international community remains committed to working with and supporting the country long term. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union has pledged its continued support towards vulnerable communities facing food shortages in Malawi. The EU Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid and Crisis Management made the pledge at the end of his 3-day visit to Malawi. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Nearly half of Malawi's population is facing the worst hunger situation in a decade. This is largely because of the El Nino weather phenomenon, which caused flooding and then drought, leaving 6.7 million Malawians in need of food aid. During his visit to Chikwawa district over the weekend, EU Commissioner Christos Stylianides told people how much the EU has already helped Malawi.
Since El Nino started affecting Malawi, the European Union has allocated over 16 million in emergency assistance in humanitarian field alone, and, of course, disaster risk reduction projects to help the countries most vulnerable.
Some cash has been given directly to the vulnerable communities to enable them to buy food and other basic necessities from the market. The assistance, he said, is part of the wider $55.1 million package for the whole of Southern Africa. Early this year, the Southern African Development Community declared that 30 million people were food insecure in the region. The commissioner also said the EU will be providing $180.1 million of development aid in Malawi for the resilience and the rural development action of relevance to the El Nino response.
We are committed to help with this emergency for as long as it takes. Our response will continue in the course of next year. You know, El Nino is a recurring phenomenon. Our common approach must go beyond immediate relief.
The EU-funded projects in southern Malawi includes an irrigation scheme in Zomba. Beatrice Wisik is a single mother of five children. She is a beneficiary of the project. She says this is her second harvest of the year, and she says she's now a changed person. She says being a single mother of many children, she was one of the poorest people in the community, but she says she has benefited a lot from this irrigation project. Now she's able to feed her family and send all her children to school. The EU humanitarian aid will continue until the first harvest in March 2017. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The United States says it is deeply concerned by the loss of life, injuries, and damages in Cameroon as a result of protests that turned violent in Bamenda and Buea, capitals of the northwestern and southwestern regions of the country. English-speaking lawyers have been protesting against the use of French in courts and the lack of English versions of some legal acts and codes. Students from the University of Buea joined the strike against what they call marginalization of English-speaking Cameroonians in the education system. The State Department has called on all parties to exercise restraint and refrain from further violence. Lambert Mbom is Secretary General of the Southern Cameroon National Council in the United States. He says the undercurrent to the protest is the issue of independence for Southern Cameroon.
Cameroon has two legal systems. One is a common law system, that is the one that is practiced in the English-speaking Cameroon. And then you have the French-speaking system, that both systems were supposed to have been harmonized. So what happened is, over the years, you have had French-speaking judges appointed to the English-speaking part of Cameroon, and you have not had the same thing happening in the French-speaking part. And when those judges were appointed to the English-speaking part, some of them came in and said, we don't understand English. They don't even understand how the common law system works. And they were asking the lawyers to make their submissions in French. And because of that, the lawyer said, no, we cannot continue doing our own things in French because you guys want everything for your understanding. If you come to the English-speaking part of Cameroon and you want submissions, these submissions should be in English. The appointment of these French-speaking judges to the English-speaking part has been part of the mega scheme of the government of Cameroon to completely wipe out, eradicate anything that has to do with the Anglo-Saxon system in Cameroon.
Lambert, we hear the students at University of Buea are also on strike. Why are they on strike?
The same kind of thing. Just imagine that you prepare a student, an English speaking student, a Southern Cameroonian in English. You prepare him in the Anglo-Saxon legal system. He comes out and he's not able to practice in that system because they are imposing the French language, the French system on the Anglo-Saxon system in Cameroon, on the Southern Cameroonians. And so the teachers themselves joined forces with the lawyers in order to point out the marginalization that Southern Cameroonians are facing, not only in the legal system, but also in the educational system. And as part of that revolution that is happening in Cameroon, the students in Buea, in the University of Buea, that is one of the two English-speaking universities that we have in Cameroon, they went out today, and it has been a brutal repression of the students. As I talk to you, I just watched a video. that was sent to me this 30 minutes ago. A student was pulled out and dumped into a pit by the repressive forces of law and order, law and disorder, and they were shooting.
I'm sure all of this is not happening in a vacuum. Is there some kind of undercurrent to what's happening now?
If you look at these symptoms and you want to stay on these symptoms, then you miss the real problem. And that's what the government of La République du Cameroun is missing. They're trying to deal with symptoms. The issue of the independence of Southern Cameroons. On the 1st of October, 1960, East Cameroon, the French-speaking part of Cameroon, what we call East Cameroon at the time, gained its independence from France. On the 1st of October, 1961, Southern Cameroons gained its independence. But it gained its independence by what they call a plebiscite was done in 11th of February, 1961. And they said they were supposed to join La République. But now over the years, what has happened is, instead of us having equal rights within the system, they have continued to marginalize the people of Southern Cameroons. And we have sought a legal route to resolve this problem. We are a peace-loving people, and we have been asking La République over the years that respect our independence.
Lamba Mbombe is the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroon National Council in the United States. You're speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 29th. Let's send shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon, and Radio Hot Cocoa, also in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The United Nations Special Representative of the Secretary General to South Sudan says she is immensely disappointed that the hopes and aspirations of South Sudanese have gone unfulfilled. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
Ellen Margaret Loy says tens of thousands of South Sudanese continue to flee their homes and live as internally displaced persons or refugees in neighboring countries due to the ongoing conflict and worries about the threats they face wherever they live. Loy, who steps down as the UN Special Representative in South Sudan this week, is calling on the international community not to abandon South Sudan.
Do not give up on South Sudan, because the people of South Sudan deserve the focus of the international community. You might be tired of politicians of this country who has inflicted this conflict on the people of South Sudan, but engage with them, try to convince them that the peace agreement has to be implemented. We cannot give up on South Sudan.
She says the UN and its partners will continue to support religious leaders, traditional chiefs, and local civil society organizations in their effort to restore peace across the country. Loy calls the situation in South Sudan heartbreaking and is pleading with the South Sudanese to learn how to live in peace with one another.
You South Sudanese really, really work hard on reconciling among yourself. Remind yourself on a daily basis that all the suffering you went through in the independence war was to get one independent South Sudan, and that you are South Sudanese regardless of your ethnic affiliation.
Loy notes that in her 2.5 years of service in South Sudan, all she has seen is insecurity and economic woes. Loy is appealing to South Sudan's leaders to silence the guns and recommit themselves to fully implementing the peace deal in order to restore the hopes of South Sudanese people.
We have not yet finished our job. We don't have peace in South Sudan. We don't have prosperity in South Sudan. But I think we all have to work for that. I'm extremely moved by having learned so much about South Sudan. I'm extremely impressed by the resilience of the South Sudanese people. I'm extremely depressed that their hopes and aspirations at their time of independence has not yet been fulfilled.
Loy says the United Nations mission in South Sudan or ANMIS was caught in the crossfire between warring parties, and ANMIS personnel often found it difficult to provide protection to vulnerable civilians. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed Ellen Margaret Loy, a Danish citizen, as his special representative in South Sudan in July 2014. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The Zimbabwean government's failed attempt to minimize the power of social and political movements using social media such as the hashtag This Flag campaign has resulted in the migration to other platforms like podcasting. Henry Beatty and Christopher Charamba have launched Zimbabwe's first political podcast titled Politics and Beyond. To hear more about the podcast, to the VOA's Zimbabwe program, reporter Mike Halvey spoke to Christopher Charamba, who is one of the hosts of the podcast.
When it comes to the podcast, it's part of this new media, and it's a platform that I and Henry wanted to explore, partly because by going on to podcast, we then thought that it would be a great opportunity for us to get out to a wider audience. And also, we get to be a little bit more unfiltered as opposed to being part of an institution. Because we produce our own show, we can say what we want and talk to whomever we want without the restrictions of the institution.
The government has been notorious for shutting down media outlets that they deem are anti-Zimbabwean government, regardless of how factual or impartial the reporting is. What makes Politics and Beyond any different to the several different media outlets that have been shut down?
So for us, we are experimenting. It's brand new. We don't even know how the government will react to something like this. There's a couple of other podcasts, but they're not political. So I think with this, it's trying to see how far we can go. What we think will help us is that we come from political families. My uncle is part of ZANU-PF and Henry's dad is PDP. So we are hoping that the podcast itself is not one-sided and it strikes a balance. We're not looking to go and attack the government or any of that sort of thing. We're just trying to present both sides of whatever argument is on the table, whatever people are discussing, and see how we can be objective about it and not focus on one end.
Who is your target market?
New media is mainly targeted towards your millennial. We feel that young people in Zimbabwe and Zimbabweans who are in the diaspora are not actively part of the political conversation. So we're generally targeting young people maybe between the ages of 18 and 25. So that's our main target. We would like to reach people in Zimbabwe, but because it's a podcast and you have to go online and get data, perhaps it's not going to reach a wider audience as possible. What we're doing, because we are working with what is known as Capital 263, it's a platform that's going to share other podcasts as well by people in Zimbabwe. We're going to get our episodes down to about 5 megabytes and send them via WhatsApp as well.
Where can people find more information on the podcast, and how can interested parties that are trying to be guests or join the conversation get a hold of you or Mr. Beatty?
On Facebook, we have a page, Politics and Beyond. On Twitter, we have a Twitter account, Beyond PolyZW. And my Twitter handle is at Chris Charamba. Henry's Twitter handle is at Henry Beatty. So you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, Christopher Farai Charamba on Facebook, Tawanda Henry on Facebook. Our social media pages is where we've started with. Our SoundCloud page, Politics and Beyond, is where you can get to listen to the podcast episodes. We are hoping to get onto different platforms. We're definitely going to put the podcast onto iTunes as well. We're going to put it onto podcasts for those with Android phones. So we're trying to get as much reach as we possibly can. But definitely on Twitter, at Beyond PolyZW, and on Facebook, the page name is Politics and Beyond.
That was Christopher Charamba, one of the hosts of Zimbabwe's first political podcast titled Politics and Beyond. He spoke with VOA Zimbabwe program from Harare. U.S. President Barack Obama proudly hailed the opening of U.S. ties with Cuba after 50 years of hostility and reacted diplomatically to the death of former President Fidel Castro, expressing condolences to his family. President-elect Donald Trump has criticized Obama's Cuba policies and released a toughly worded statement calling Fidel Castro a brutal dictator. The differences in tone may signal a major shift in relations between Washington and Havana, as VOA White House correspondent Cindy Singh reports.
President Obama considers opening up U.S. ties to Cuba after more than 50 years of bitter estrangement one of his signature foreign policy achievements. He visited the Caribbean island nation in March, the first sitting U.S. president to do so since 1928.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
The two countries have reopened their embassies after more than 50 years. U.S. cruise ships are now docking in Cuba, and there are regular flights by U.S. airlines to the island. But the death of 90-year-old Fidel Castro and the election of Republican Donald Trump are raising questions about what will happen to the warming of U.S.-Cuban ties. A senior Trump advisor, Kellyanne Conway, told ABC News this week that Trump is open to any number of possibilities on resetting U.S. relations with Cuba, but that he will demand concessions in return.
We remain very firm that when you open up diplomatic relations, as President Obama has with Cuba and Fidel Castro in the last several years, that to get nothing in return, including political prisoners and assurances that people on the island of Cuba will be free politically and economically. I mean, I've personally met, I'm sure you have, victims of Fidel Castro's oppression and his torture and his imprisonment.
Obama's shift in policy toward Havana also has been criticized by a number of lawmakers from both major parties, including Senator Ted Cruz, whose father is from Cuba.
I very much hope that we don't see any U.S. government officials going to Fidel Castro's funeral. I hope we don't see Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and Democrats lining up to lionize a murderous tyrant and thug.
The White House has not announced who will be traveling to Fidel Castro's funeral on December 4th. Although future U.S. policy toward Havana is uncertain, Trump likely would agree with Obama's statement that the Cuban people must know they have a friend and partner in the United States. Cindy Sain, VOA News, The White House.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somalia's presidential elections, scheduled to begin this week, have been postponed for a third time, the electoral body said on Monday. Omar Mohamed Abdulle, head of Somalia's electoral body, said elections slated for Wednesday will not happen as planned. Abdulle did not offer a new date, but said the next president will be elected before the end of this year. Somalia's parliament members will elect the new president. However, parliamentary elections to elect new lawmakers have not been completed in all regions of the country. The parliamentary voting was marred by irregularities and corruption. Police in the Midwestern city of Columbus say at least 9 people were injured on the campus of Ohio State University when an attacker drove a vehicle into a crowd of pedestrians and then began stabbing them. The suspect was shot and killed by police. Ohio State University identified the attacker as Abdul Razak Ali Artan, a freshman at the school. Community members in Columbus tell VOA Somali Service the man was of Somali descent and was about 20 years old. The Obama administration has expanded its legal authority to attack the al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group al-Shabaab. Citing senior U.S. officials, the New York Times reported on Monday the administration has deemed al-Shabaab to be part of the armed conflict that Congress authorized against the perpetrators of the September 11, 2001 attacks. And that is it for this Tuesday, November 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA.